everyone, and welcome to Unplug It as we build towards round one. We are finally here. We've spoken about a couple of practice matches. There's been tribunal hearings, and we watched a weekend of footy last week that whet the appetite. There was some good stuff in there, but obviously it doesn't feel like it's quite started yet until your own side is in action, not to mention it plays havoc with the ladder for a while. But it'd be nice to get underway this week. We played Geelong at Cadinia Park in one of our more fascinating round one matches in a long time. I know they're all fascinating, but so much to pick apart in this one. Where are we at and how much of the game is determined by them? Obviously, if you look at Geelong, they had their moments last year, but ultimately were disappointing. So what happens next in that Geelong journey? Do they do a mini rebuild? Do they do one of their quick rejuvenations? Do they bounce straight back into contention? What type of Geelong side are we coming up against? I actually feel like I know what we'll do and I know roughly where we're at and what we'll provide. And I think we're a pretty decent side. And it's really a question of what they look like. And I think we've given them trouble at home and away over the last 3 years, beaten them a couple of times. Our pace hurts them a little bit. So, really fascinated. Probably we haven't beaten Geelong at Cadinia Park in 25 years and in reality haven't really looked like it apart from a couple of 2004-ish we were okay, but it certainly feels like this is our best chance and the best shape we're in to do it. Yeah, so bring it on, obviously. They can open 1,000 grandstands if they want. It shouldn't mean shit really at the end of the day. Well, exactly. And they'll do another one in 3 weeks probably. But yeah, look, there's a lot of things where you look at it and go, oh, get Geelong at Geelong in round one and all of this stuff's happening. But at the end of the day, it shouldn't matter. But H, yeah, it's a quick build-up. We're a few days away from the game and it has snuck up quickly, even though at the same time we've been waiting a little while.
Yeah, the Geelong ground that still can't point a curve in a wing. But it's as I think we said last week, it's probably going to be the best time to get them. I mean, yeah, opening round, you think they should be probably up and about and their home game. They've finally going to let the locals into the new stand. And it's just that thing you sort of think about. You go, well, Geelong are pretty well over the last few years. They're kind of a notoriously slow starters at the moment. They're not a quick team. They're just probably not right. They're not at their peak. They a team who does peak late generally. And finish off really strong, and it's got a feeling of this is our time to get them. And we saw it in the last round last year, as we're also saying, why we wouldn't just continue that same form on again. Because at the end of the day, I feel like we've improved. Our list has improved since that game. Geelong, I don't know, they feel a bit stagnant. I don't think they've really, they've made a few list changes, but they haven't really brought in much that's going to make them a different team. I don't think there's a lot that actually changes the way they're going to play. They're not going to, they haven't brought in like another danger field as a superstar. They haven't, there's nothing there that makes me look and go, they should be really dangerous. It's just the fact that it's in Geelong, and that's the only way you go, that's what you'd be concerned about. So, on paper, you look at the thing, we win that game. Then you add the Geelong factor, and you go, okay, look, it's probably going to be a bit tougher than what we think, but there's still a fair bit of comfort there in the end, though. So, yeah, it's a good, I guess, launch that if we go down there and I mean, we win convincingly. You go, hey, fantastic start. But, yeah, we don't want to really go down there and not put in a performance and not show what we want to see for the rest of this season. If it's if we're sluggish and we just fall back into perhaps the level or the game style Geelong want to play and we don't allow ourselves to be who we are, then, yeah, that'd be a little bit concerning.
Nick, it feels good to obviously be previewing a game, not previewing a tribunal hearing this week. Obviously, that's a much better outcome, but it's exciting times.
It is, yeah. It's taken a little while to get to this point, but I think I'm now kind of at the point where I'm like, I can't wait for the footy to be back. I know it was kind of back for some people last weekend, but you know, for a lot of the competition, it wasn't. And it didn't really feel like, you know, opening round of the footy. It didn't feel like your standard round one. We know it was, they called it round zero for some ridiculous reason, but didn't mind the fact that it was all played in the northern states. Like, I don't really have an issue with that. But my issue was that half the team wasn't playing, and it just didn't feel like there was really any buzz around it at all. So it is nice to be kind of a week down the track, feeling like we're about to play footy again, and there is a bit of a buzz and there is some excitement, and Geelong is always a tough ask, but I think they're very beatable, and I think you said, Parker, I think we're at a point where we know what to expect from our team. What we don't know is what to expect from Geelong, and I think that's one of the real positives out of, you know, Ross's first year back in the seat, is that the team, you know what you're going to get from them. It's not that they're predictable, because I think they play in a way that is still exciting, and there's a lot of X factor and pace and run and all that sort of stuff. But we know that we're going to get that Ross Lyon group effort. And so I think we can pretty confident that we're going to turn up and have a crack. Whether it's enough ultimately is going to be the question. But I think we know now what to expect from this group.
Hopefully the last time we uttered this sentence, last winning at India Park was 1999. So hopefully that changes. Barry Hall kicked four. Ben Walton kicked a sealer at the end. Robert Harvey got cleaned up by Gary Hocking and then led the Saints to victory. We were 25 points down in the last quarter, kicking against a five-goal breeze, and then kicked six in a row to win anyway. One of our great wins of that era. And then
how many name changes has that stadium gone through?
I know. But that was peak Tim Watson. We won that game and went 7-3 and were third on the ladder, and then became the worst side in history within a month, basically. And really never won a game again under his coaching. So one would argue that that's so St Kilda. Still a few talking points around selection. I think Nick's got potentially some inside word around the sub, so we'll chat about that later. But wanted to give a little bit of a big shout out in actual facts before we get away. A little bit later on, we'll have a chat to Craig Davenport as well, who is a bit of a cult hero. But obviously football is built upon fans and, you know, the strength of that supporter base, and most of the good memories you have are not just results, but of the times you've spent watching games with certain people. And so my family, I want to give a shout out first of all to Graham Davey, passionate St Kilda supporter his entire life, who tragically passed away during the week. My family moved to Gippsland in the early 90s, and my dad and Graham met over local footy and became best mates. And having lived in Melbourne previously, they still had a passion to go watch St Kilda. So they set up the Gippsland St Kilda supporters group, which every game that St Kilda played in Melbourne, they would hire a minibus, which actually got bigger and ended up being a coach. And for the 97 grand final, it was three coaches. We had that many people heading down, and they ran that together. And, you know, those bus trips when I was a kid, 10, 11, 12, 13, are some of the best memories I've ever had. The, you know, St Kilda song blaring down, and then obviously especially on the way back, and people would be, you know, enjoying a couple of ales and singing songs. And Graham would always lead that charge. I remember with Up There Kazali that would play, when it says here, the Mighty Roar, he'd scream Winmar all the time. That it became that sort of catchphrase. I remember as a kid, the 96 Anzac Cup Grand Final, ironically, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, there were a group of Carlton fans behind us who were very rowdy before the game. And Graham, when we started to get on a roll, which was pretty early, every time we'd kick a goal, he turned around, put the hand in the air and say, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, log on tram, leaves in 5 minutes, best be on it, see you later. But just a great fella every time you'd go back to Gippsland. He'd talk about this podcast and say, I heard you speak to such and such, or, you know, how do you think we'll go this week? Always very positive, always very optimistic, and it's always sad when you lose a part of the family. But that was a great experience watching footy with him and his family. So a shout out to his wife, Maria, and his children, Ryan and Michelle. It's a very sad scenario, so it'll be a fond farewell for him this week. But I certainly hope his boys can get the job done for him on Saturday. He deserves that and more. But yeah, I thought I'd give a little bit of a tribute, Nick, to a passionate Sainter who was certainly very close to my family as well.
No, very well said. And I think it's important to remember not just the people that are important to us, but the people that have had our footy club such a big part of their life. And yeah, I think we all have people, friends, family that are like that. So no, very well said, mate. Very well said.
Yeah, and speaking of obviously, you know, passion and that type of thing, it's always big when these things get underway, but also when you hear about debutants, and that's one thing we can confirm. We'll go through the injury list a little bit later on, but Darcy Wilson, and I think most of us probably expected that this was going to happen, Nick, but he will play his first game for the Saints, and I actually sense he's a pretty fair chance to stay there for most of the year.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he's had a ripping preseason. The kid doesn't stop running. If anyone saw the two practice games, I think what you saw then was kind of, this is the baseline to expect from Darcy Wilson. You know, all the word from training on the track in the gym is that Darcy Wilson is one of the hardest workers, hardest trainers, most professional. You know, everything that people were talking about, Mateus Filippo last year, Darcy Wilson has the potential to be something similar this season. I think you're right. He plays this week, and you know, barring injury, I think that he sticks the rest of the season in the team. But he might not be the only debutant, which I wanted to. You know, if anyone I think who listens to this show knows that we have friends in high places, and got a call,
and we don't go with mail unless we're barely confident.
That's right. Mm. That's right. Mm. But the mail is that inside the club there is a very, very strong push for the sub to be one of Hugo Garcia or Lance Collard. Okay. So keep an eye out on selection, because the expectation is that one of them will be in the team too.
It's a good position to be in, because I got the feeling when you said debutant that it was going to be Schoenmakers who took 11 marks the other day, and the fact that we then go to a couple of these other kids and I'm like, well, there's a few of them, isn't there? So it's a nice position to be in. And I guess, H, the positive is on top of all of that, that, you know, Brad Crouch and Marcus Windhager removed from the injury list, Josh Battle removed from the injury list, Jack Sinclair did all the things he had to do up till tomorrow/Thursday's hit out. So obviously Clark and Howard and clearly Webster and probably Butler out of our best 22, but maybe that's it.
Yeah, it's the injury list started to look a bit like last year's, the way it was going to begin with. But yeah, you had a look at it and go, okay, well, a lot of these injuries could be gone before round one comes, because we're basically looking at them 3 weeks before we played. It might have said 1 or 2 weeks, and you think, oh, yeah, but that was actually almost a three-week gap from the update to when we would actually be taking the field. So it was a bit of, oh, okay, most of these players probably will be right in that case. I mean, from what it sounds if Sinclair gets 3 this week in training, it sounds like he plays. That's a huge input in for us for round one. I mean, might be a bit rusty, not playing in the practice games, but I mean, in all Australian, they're hard to replace, but generally they should be able to pick it straight up again and go from where he left off last year. And Windhager getting back, straight away again. The whole situation there where exactly like it was, you call it Groundhog Day, but
yeah, well, basically
mirrored Groundhog Day, in the opposite end. So and the word that Jack Hayes has been out training too, you think, well, he may not be far away either if the opportunity arose for him. But if we're starting to get all these players back, hopefully this year we keep them on the field. Hopefully they all get able to get through, and we get through with minimal injuries this season. And it's going to give us the best chance, and it's going to give us a great chance to, one, prove Brad Johnson wrong. That'd be a great thing to do. And, yeah, just have another shot at it again and actually get to the final this year with good confidence, a lot more confidence than what we had last year. I mean, we did go up against the rampaging Giants at that time. They were unlucky to not make the grand final and even go on and win it. Every chance at keeping a good list together this year, and we just keep rolling on for the whole season.
Well, Brad Johnson tipped us to finish 17th in 2020 when we made the finals. So his track record around us hasn't been super. I would expect that we're a decent chance of proving him wrong, at least to some degree. And it'd be interesting, Nick, with Butler probably a week or so away, whether that swings them into Collard or whether they stick with Garcia or which way they go on that, because Collard, bit of a natural goal kicker, and his pace might hurt Geelong potentially.
It's a really interesting one. I think if Butler's fit, he's probably in the team. So whether they decide to go with the two smalls, you know, the Higgins-Butler combination, or in this case, Higgins-Collard up forward, is a question mark. But I don't know. I mean, Garcia's been super impressive, and I think that he probably has that ability to go through the middle, can play off half back, can play off half forward, can probably swing through the forward line as well. Maybe that versatility gets him over the line, but Collard certainly has a bit of that X factor, and certainly that bit of run and carry, bit of the, you know, see ball, get ball when it's in the air. I don't know. I really don't know what to expect, but I think if it was me, I'd probably leaning towards Garcia just because of that extra versatility. But yeah, Collard certainly looks like an exciting prospect, that's for sure.
Obviously, club debutants, so you think Riley Bonner will play in all likelihood. So
I almost surely.
Yeah.
He's pretty well came along with just the right time to take that spot of Webster. Like you, it's almost a lucky pickup when you look at it now. It's we took him with our very last pick, and you go, well, he's pretty much going to slide straight in. We didn't expect that to happen in any case. We thought, well, look, if he started playing good football in Sandringham, and he may get an opportunity, but yeah, it seems like it's just going to fall straight into his lap. And he showed us that he played really good footy in the two practice matches. I mean, a back flanker kicking a couple of goals, and that's shows he's dangerous and shows he's going to be very handy. So it's
Webster replacements are a really interesting one, because obviously Bonner comes into the team for Webster, but they clearly don't play the same position. I mean, Webster has kind of turned into that lockdown small defender. Obviously, Ben Patton has played that role in the past, and he's not going to play for at least half the season, probably more. So in that case, with Bonner coming in to play, I guess, more of that running halfback role, which either means Sinclair's not playing or they play alongside each other, or Sinclair moves more into the middle. Who takes that lockdown spot? Is it Stocker? I mean, Stocker probably fits the bill to some respect. He's strong, he's tough, he's hard. He probably doesn't have the pace.
Yeah, and you don't want Nass doing it.
No. Is there anyone else?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is there anyone else that really fits the bill in that spot? I think it's probably Stocker,
well,
right?
He can play small as well if a small forward's a problem Yeah,
probably not when you've got Hawkins and
then, no, who's the other bloke down there for them? Henry, who kicked 38 goals or something last year. So you could envisage that Cordy and Battle get the talls, Cameron and Hawkins, and then the third of those players goes to maybe Ollie Henry, and then obviously they're missing Gary Rowan, so that's, and Cam Guthrie through the middle, but they're the two on their injury list, but that. It's handy outs, but yeah, then it's Stocker. Obviously, you want Wanganeen, Miller, Sinclair, and Bonner. Obviously, they have to play on someone, but you want them getting 85 possessions between the three of them, ideally, which means one of them probably has to play on the wing, which might be Nass, maybe, just to see which way you want to look at it. So,
yeah, I don't know. Wilkie might go to Cameron.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it depends how far up the ground he plays, because he seemed to be creeping further up the ground towards the end of the year last year. I don't know whether that was just a ball chasing thing, he was just trying to get into the game, but it seemed to happen a bit more often than what that was.
Yeah, so he did push up a bit more.
Yeah, so if I would expect if he's going that high, Wilkie won't be chasing him that far. He'll let him go up there and we'll have someone else pick him up. Whether that be on, I don't know, if Batchel plays, he might go up there, but yeah, I'm not sure if he's going to be on the list or not in the team this week. But Wilkie wouldn't be following that far up the ground. But that's where it becomes versatile. If they have the small forward line while Cameron is up the field, he's able to play that both those roles. He can step in and take the small forward, or yeah. So it's a while he's down there, you expect him to take it, but yeah, at least we've got that bit of versatility.
And are we set on Cordy coming in for Howard? He's a natural replacement, right?
You'd think so.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. There's a few of those options and around Geelong in terms of looking at the key to beating them. It is pace that we heard them with in the past. They would know that and they've obviously had a bit of time to work on it. And, you know, they'll usually unearth something. Their depth through the middle's taken a hit. Obviously, it depends on guys like Tanner Bruin and those sorts of guys giving them, Parfitt and these sorts of players, giving them a bit more drive. Does Tom Jai Stewart Clark. Spend more time in the – yeah, does Stewart spend more time in the middle, or does he still play that role of halfback? I mean, he's the key. If you limit his drive, then that hurts them significantly. Clearly, they've got some stars on their list, but I think there's more deficiencies. I think basically if you use Geelong as a marker – if we don't finish ahead of them this year, we won't make the eight. If we finish ahead of them, we can. So it's one of those, and that's not to say they'll be a bad side. I just think they smack straight into the middle of the table somewhere. So, they're almost a marker for us.
The Stewart one's a really interesting one because Cooper Sharman played that kind of defensive forward role on that kind of intercept defender quite well. I think he might have even done it on Stewart at one point.
Yes.
The coming back into the team with a fully fit Max King, fully fit Tim Embry, does Sharman still have a role to play in this team?
Definitely.
I think so.
I think his match-winning capabilities, like he didn't dominate the practice matches, but he looks pretty good. I think he's a real point of difference and an X factor. I think, as you say, he can either lock down or he can just be a creative third target. He's probably the best kick for, Membry's a pretty good kick as well, but he's probably the best kick for goal in our side. Mm. So if you were to ask me who I'd like to have a shot inside 50 on our list, it would be him before anyone else. I think he's, pretty important as a third wheel, excellent in the final last year against the Giants. Mm. So hopefully he can find that consistency.
Yeah, I think you're right. And he's shown that versatility now that we hadn't seen previously. You know, he played those few games as that intercept defender a year and a half ago or so. I think he showed in the second half of last year that he can be a real point of difference and almost be a bit of a focal point, which then takes the pressure off someone like a Max King as well.
Definitely. It'll be... I think we get those matchups right and, give ourselves every chance. It's never easy to win down there. I mean, they beat Melbourne and Port and Sydney and teams like that down there and lost to the Giants, Freo and the Bulldogs, I think. So we'll see. But it's our best chance on paper since probably 2004 when we lost an epic to them by a kick down there. I would think a couple of years ago we kicked the first five against them and then only got overrun in the last 10 minutes. It certainly feels a little bit better for us this time. Before we hear from our special guest, Tim Embry obviously had some words. We know that was a sad point at the end of last season and a bit of uncertainty that there was around that, Nick, and it showed a lot of courage. Obviously, there's, with a name, so to speak, there's that opportunity to spread the word and raise awareness, and he didn't have to take that message on, but it's good that he did.
Yeah, look, I think there's a few things. A, it's obviously good to see him up and running, healthy, he looked happy, he sounded confident, strong. That was the main takeaway. The second point is the bravery and courage it takes to go out and say those things in front of a camera.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that struggle with mental illness and their emotional health and all these things that it's really important to see public figures and your heroes talk about their issues and kind of normalize these things because it is a normal part of society and it is a real issue that people don't talk enough about it. So firstly, great to see him happy and healthy and strong again. Secondly, well done for doing it and taking the steps that you have done. Lastly, I guess for me, it kind of takes a bit of a turn at this point where I don't think it answers any of the questions that everybody had at the end of last year. And I'm not saying that everybody needs to know the details of what happened that night and that morning. But from a pure football perspective, that's the biggest game that this footy club has played for a long time. You know, senior leader of the footy club, I do think that there are some questions to be answered as to, you know, why it came to this, all these sorts of things that I don't think he spoke to, and whether or not it's his job to do that, I'm torn. But I do think that you know, the fans, the members, whatever it is, and it sounds awful, and I don't mean it in a way that he's got to answer to everybody. I certainly don't mean it that way. But there is a lot of speculation, most of it wrong and gross and horrible and awful, that I think could be cleared up with a pretty simple statement as to this is what happened, and this is what I was dealing with. Because I think that speculation and those rumors and all those horrible things that we all went through that day and that night and that week, that was rife across the internet. You know, it's got to stop, and it's not going to stop until some of those questions are answered. And so I thought that the statement kind of fell flat a little bit when it came to that. And that the last thing was that I kind of didn't like it turning into a come and get your ticket for Spuds game. That part felt a little bit forced. And when you're talking about someone's well-being and mental health, it shouldn't turn into a promo marketing event, I didn't think, but that's just me.
Yeah, and I think it's spot on. I think it's, you know, it's a, you don't want to shy away from the elephant in the room in these things. And I've often been of the belief that, you know, a lot of times when people discuss topics, it's linear. There's one way or the other way. It's possible for multiple things to be true at the same time. And that's the case in so many aspects that I think showed a lot of courage. Seems to be, you know, a terrific fellow, great leader, fantastic to see him healthy, well done in all of that respect. But does it answer every question? No. But at the same time, is he obligated to answer every question? No. But both of those things are true at the same time. Like there is a lot of that grey area that's still floating around and a lot of innuendo, which he didn't create, but it's still there. And yes, it was an important game. And yes, it did hurt. And yes, there are those things that are relevant to it. And sometimes, you know, those personal battles do get so strong and so hard that, you know, those other things don't matter. And that will always be more important than football. I think everybody agrees with that. It's just, yeah, if the purpose is to answer questions, it didn't necessarily answer all of them, H, I would think.
No, I mean, yes, I think, as Nick's saying, people want to know, but do people need to know? And it's, we've got him back. That's the main thing. He's still here. He's still with us. And he's back on the field. And, but on top of that, also, he's back with his family. And that's the main thing out of everything that you sort of go, that's what we want. If he was back there and not playing football, you go, well, that's great.
It. Yeah.
But he's back where he was completely. Fantastic. It's the fact he's been able to get himself back out there to that point. The fact he's been able to, speak about it even. It wouldn't be an easy thing to do. So what we've received and what we've seen and that, honestly, you can't really ask for much more. And yeah, watch him get back out there round one and hopefully kicks a bag and just thinks it's the best thing ever to happen. And I guess it's great to just see him back out there again.
I get 100%, and I agree with all that, H. I guess the example that I come back to is that had it been a physical injury, had it been had a few drinks and jumped the fence and broke an ankle or stepped in a hole and did a you know knee ligament or like whatever it is, fallen down the stairs and broken a leg, like. That would have been out. It would have been straight down the line. This is what happened. This is what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
We hope he's coming back. It is different. It is different with mental health, and I accept that. But I also don't like it because I think it's part of what creates the stigma around it, is that nobody talks about it and no one talks about the importance of this stuff and what happens when people have mental health crises. And so that creates this external stigma, speculation, rumors, innuendo, all that stuff, because no one talks about it. We kind of beat around the bush and we kind of allude to things and whatever, but no one kind of talks about it straight down the line. And that's my only issue. Not that I think Tim Embry should be out there talking about every little detail of his life and whatever. I certainly don't think that. But I do think the way that we approach mental health compared to physical health and injury is different. And I think we need to get to a point where it's just part of life, because it's what so many people are dealing with in normal life.
Yeah, and there's no question about that. I mean, there is something wrong, like there would be if you had a broken arm or you had a virus or any of those sorts of things. If someone's sick, you go to the doctor. Someone will write a card saying, get well soon. Someone will ring you up and say, hope you feel better. Can I do anything for you? And it needs to be treated almost in that same way. It doesn't need to be the, oh, we better be quiet about this and hush, hush. And on the one hand, obviously, through him talking about it, that's not happening, which is good. It's important to start that dialogue, because the consequences of these things can be unbelievably severe. So obviously anything needs to be done to eliminate that. And, you know, as a club, unfortunately, we've seen instances very close to home of that being a reality. So, anything that could be done to better that, and you know, all power to Tim for trying that, even if it doesn't necessarily answer everyone's questions. I think he's putting his, you know, one foot in front of the other, and that's a very good thing. And, yeah, hopefully anybody who listens to it at any time, even if they think, oh, you know, my old mate's been a little bit different the last couple of weeks, you know, he's not normally like that. You give him a call or do that type of stuff, even if it's just something small in that sense. And that's all you can really ask at this point, I think, out of conversations like that.
Yeah, spot on.
Obviously, it's been a reasonably heavy start to the show, but we appreciate you sticking with us through all of that. We'll lighten it up a little bit with our special guest, who was a cult hero in the early 90s. There's no doubt about that. And you'll hear a little bit about a couple of his footballing heroes, and he'd actually look a tiny bit like one of them. I speak of Craig Devenport.
Off foot handball. Newport attacks the ball. Low goes to ground. It bounces. Kelly, the Cobham runner towards the boundary line, is caught. Devenport.
Well, the next guest, we're talking about a period where St Kilda emerged in the early 90s under Ken Sheldon through that 90-91-92 period. And you look at the numbers of Craig Devenport and it reads 94 games. But if you remember back through that era, he pops up in a lot of significant moments and a lot of key memories and key stages through that period, and had a really significant impact for a few years. They had a very good final series in 92, had a very good final in 91, one where St Kilda obviously could have gone a little bit deeper, and played some great footy through 1990, ended up at Carlton and ironically played in an Anzac Cup grand final against the Saints, which was a memorable night for the Saints as well. But Craig, nice to have you with us. It's been a fascinating journey, and we want to get stuck into having a chat about the career.
Thanks, Darren. Yeah, it's good to be here. Good to see you guys.
Now, recruited from Croydon, can you sort of take us through your journey that led you to the Saints in the late 80s?
Yeah, it started off actually at Seville Footy Club, basically. My best friend as a kid was a guy called Shane Heal, who you guys might know, who's played about 4 or 5 Olympics in basketball. So my early days was basketball and soccer. I only played probably a handful of games before I turned 15, there was a recruiter guy at the club. His name was Murray Ablett, and his dad was my mum's boss at a place in Ringwood. And so they come and saw me a couple of times, and I was fortunate enough to kick a few goals playing for Croydon at that stage when I was 15. I think we kicked 37 goals in two games. I kicked 37 goals in two games. So I was the competition obviously wasn't that good, let me tell you. But so, I stood out some way. I was in the Carlton zone. And that was known as that days. Obviously, we didn't have the draft as it is now. And when you turn 15.5, whoever's in what zone, the recruitment officer could be at VFL House back at that stage and put your name down and say you're on that list. It was. I turned 15.5 on a Sunday, so VFL House wasn't open. I was a massive St Kilda supporter. And Murray Abbott went to VFL House that Monday morning, 6 o'clock. The Carlton guy arrived at 9. I said, hopefully you're here for the same person, and Murray got to go first. So from that morning, I was a St Kilda player.
What's it like walking into the St Kilda club rooms as a massive St Kilda fan and seeing Plugger and Spartan and all those guys that you would have idolised or watched as a kid growing up? What was that moment like?
I was Trevor Barker fanatic, you know. He was just my life as a kid, you know. Like we didn't win any games, but we had Trevor and we had Robbo. Trevor was pretty influential of a part of getting me there because you know how much I loved him. And unfortunately, when I was 14, my father and Shane Hill's father, they passed away in the same accident. So after that time when St Kilda come, Trevor was very influential in helping me in a lot of ways. So when to walk in and see him and it's just amazing for me because, you know, I hadn't played much footy and I was a basketball or soccer player, but I always wanted to play footy. Walking in, it's still surreal when I think back. People say, you know, would you like to be playing now for the money? I said, yeah, of course, but you can't ever take away from what I did with, you know, having Trevor there and to play with him at games and, you know, just the whole, it was a different situation back then than it is now anyway, as we know.
So your first game is against Essendon in round 5 in 89. Assume you've played 4 reserve games before that match or possibly up to 4. Take us through to 4 weeks leading up to the round 5 match where you debuted.
Yeah, 89. So I think I had been emergency back in those days. It was only 18+2. I'd been emergency like 15 or 16 times in the previous 2 years. I'd broken my jaw in 88, so I missed a lot of that year. Started off pretty well at the start of the season in the reserves. We played the grand final in the reserves in 87. Which was pretty good, being a 17-year-old playing that. So I had some good grounding. It started off, I think we played against Collingwood in round 4 and played pretty well. And then I remember Spud coming to me on Tuesday night and said, just get around Plugger's legs on Tuesday night training because if you do it right, you're going to get a game. So all I did was just follow him around the training Tuesday and Thursday night. And it was pretty surreal. Barks was played and he picked me up for the game and I went drove to Windy Hill with him and it was just amazing to have, you know, players like him. Jeff Cunningham, all those players who I loved. A good story about that game is I think in the first quarter, you grow up, there's probably when you grow up in the late 70s and 80s, you remember some players, Timmy Watson, Peter Dacos, Doug Hawkins, they're the 3 players who I liked from the teams. I remember trying to tackle someone and then Timmy Watson just ran past and bumped me. He ran off and the 32 looked like it was just like the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life when he ran past and he just turned around and smirked and he goes, bit do better than that, son. And it was just amazing to see, you know, like you're out there that was a pretty cool moment for me.
Now, I imagine it was always the goal-kicking targets in terms of how you were going to get yourself into that side as a young forward, and that came to fruition through 1990, playing all 22 games, some memorable ones in there, 5 against the Cats in a game we lost at Waverley, 6 in a win over Fitzroy, big game against Brisbane at Moorabbin when Plugger kicked probably 1,000, started the year well against Footscray, and 5 in the first quarter against West Coast in a game we led by 50 points and got rolled in. But can you sort of take us through that 1990? Would have been a special year to establish yourself like that.
Yeah. It was Gary Colling, actually, who went to Ken Sheldon in the 90 preseason and said, we're going to put Devo back down. I think he's going to be a good backman. To learn the game. So they put me in the back pocket through that pre-season and all those goals I kicked basically was I was moved down for a quarter or two and always started in the back pocket. But I had a love playing in the back pocket, love had a run off spud because, you know, you didn't like kicking CJ Tambor to you every time. But yeah, so that was where that year started from. And I think not to be forward pocket or half forward flank the whole game really helped me. And learning the actual game, because what some people don't know is my 100th game of footy was my, I think, 45th senior AFL game of footy. So I hadn't played, you know, kids have played 100 games before they're 12, 13. I didn't have that upbringing. So I was still learning every second of every game I was playing in the AFL. And you know, when I look back, I was far behind, you know, because I hadn't had that 100, 200 games as a kid.
So what was it like at the end of 1990, you kind of top five disposal getter in the team, you know, you kicked 28, 29 goals for the year. Like, did you feel like you'd kind of made it and consolidated a spot in the team, or how was it going into 1991 after that season?
Yep. No, definitely I did. And I had gained a lot of confidence in that. With about 2 weeks to go in the preseason 91, I was kicking the ball at training and my quad just burst. So I think I missed the first 12 or 13 weeks of that year in 91, which was hard, especially after coming off every game. And so then it took me three or four reserve games to get back in towards the end of 91, probably start around 16 or 17. And then we played, you know, I was lucky enough to be in there for the finals again, but I was truly underdone for a lot of the rest of that year. The final against Geelong was a really good game. The quad really made things hard. I had a really big preseason and put a three or four kilos on in the right areas and, yeah, looking forward to it. But then, yeah, it just went pop.
So first your way back into the team, started off okay, but then started picking up really well. You've 23 touches, 20 touches, 24 touches, leads into the finals. You feel like you're definitely consolidated back into the team at that point. And how was the confidence going into those finals?
That first final against Geelong was, you know, amazing. I think it was the first final in 20 or 23 years, whatever it was. And we had a good team. We were really confident. You know, it was a great game. I think Lockett and Billy Brownless, I think they kicked, 18 or 19 goals between them as full forwards. Like, what a game. Mm. And, I think we lost by 7 points, but we were certainly in there. There was a couple of things in the second or third quarter which could have made that game better for us. I thought we had a great team that year to go further. I think Gary Ablett had a bit to say. Well, I think he might have knocked out Berkey and Brownie that game, which, you know, when you've only got two on the bench, it makes it difficult. So, I loved playing that game. I've got really fond memories. I played on Andrew Buse and I loved, it was a great atmosphere. It was at VFL Park. We would like to play that at MCG, but it was at VFL Park. It was sort of our home ground after that the next year. So, no, it was good.
We've had David Grant and Nathan Burke on the podcast at various times, and unfortunately because of Gary Ablett, neither of them remember that game at all, unfortunately. But my dad's often spoken about the roar of the crowd when the first goal of the game was kicked by Gilbert McAdam, given the lengthy drought. Into 92, obviously, there's a lot to talk about through that season. You've had 60 shots at goal, had a terrific year. We'll talk about your final series later where you were positive, but I guess the question that a lot of people would want to know listening to this podcast, what did Ken Shelton say to you on the boundary at the MCG?
Right, of course.
We have had him on, Bomber. So.
Have you?
We have.
Yeah. So I took his daughter out the night before, and he wasn't very happy with that. What happened. No, that's one story, but I wouldn't believe that one. Kenny and I had a really good relationship, and he was great for my career at the end of the day, you know, because he was playing in 89, and then he coached in 90. So we had that player sort of, then coached, but he gave me a chance, sort of grabbed me at the start of the preseason, said, we're going to do this. And you know, here's a slate. I'm just going to wipe the slate clean of whatever's happened in the past. This is how we're working it. So he actually got a blackboard and wrote all stuff on it and just rubbed it all out and go, that's your slate. And so that was really good. He had a different way of dealing with everyone. Like, you probably can't do it these days, but he felt like when Craig Kelly ran through me, I probably should have stopped Craig Kelly, which I still don't understand how I could have. He dragged me off and thought he'd just run down, you know, from where he was and start, you know, slapping me around a little bit. which is, you know, like at the time, you know, I knew something was pretty big, but didn't realize, you know, 40 years later, whatever, 30, how is it 30 years, 40 years later? It's 30 years later. It's still being brought up every year, every time. Yeah, Pluggett wasn't the happiest after that. Pluggett didn't play that game, but he drove me to the footy that day and we drove. Yeah, he wasn't too happy with Kenny. He thought that he might go and talk to him after the game. I said, don't worry about it, mate. And we walked out and there's, you know, just press everywhere wanting to deal with it. And it was a big week of hearing and everyone know what he said. So basically he told me I was weak because Craig Kelly ran through me and they kicked the goal.
did you have any words back to him after the game, after you kicked the goal?
No, he just come to me and said, well done. He said, you answered what I asked you to do. And so that was it. We didn't really speak too much about it during the week. He came and patted me on the head, I think, on the Tuesday night, and just that was done. You know, like it was in part of the game. And he just thought that, well, that's what I needed that time to, you know, whatever for the game. So, yeah, and we're lucky enough to get that goal at the end there, and we won by a point.
What, as Darren mentioned, kind of the finals run in 92 as well, but you had a record of playing really good footy in your three finals games. You had 26 touches in that Geelong game in 91, 17 and a goal in the elimination final over Collingwood in 92, and then 20 touches and 3 goals won in the semi-final loss to the Dogs. I mean, where does that sit, I guess, alongside your career memories or whatever, but having that I guess legacy of playing well in big games?
It's nice to look back and think at it. I mean, we, once again, you know, to lose to the Dogs that day was horrific. I mean, they jumped us on the tissue, like five or six goals, and we just couldn't get it back. They had the wind or whatever the case was, and Chris Grant was just doing his thing. Yeah, he just, I think I can remember, I played the first half in the back line. And I just remember him just running around and doing everything. Look, yeah, and then I was lucky enough to kick a few goals in the second half. We came back, sometimes lead that spark, and Kendall thought I could do that at times. So, yeah, I'm pretty proud of those games. The Collingwood game was really good. Played, you know, once again, played three quarters in the back pocket and then moved down the forward line, kick a goal in the last quarter, which helped us get over the line at that stage.
So, you talk about your relationship with Ken Sheldon.
Yep.
Obviously, then being moved on as coach of the club. And so how did you take that change after the time that he'd been there?
I thought it was sad. Kenny and I have had a couple of really good conversations in the last year. He lives up in Echuca, and I bring him up a couple of times because through the floods. So I really wanted to reach out and make sure he was okay. And we were able to really have some good conversations about it. And I was really sad when he left. He brought in Peter Hudson as, and which probably helped him get the job at the time. And when you bring a big name like that in, I think after that 3 years, Peter had probably run his race in the club. But Kenny said, from what I gather, you know, if they're going to get rid of Peter, I said that I'd go at the same time. That's how I got in there, and I'm going to stick to my word. And still, you know, still it doesn't seem right to me. I still think he should have been coach. Stan was there as he was doing other stuff as, you know, assistant coaching and stuff like that. And he got the job there, and I did like Stan at the start. But, yeah, Kenny should have been coach for sure. Having said that all, if Trevor Barker wasn't sick, he'd been coach. So, That's probably the sad part of it all. It
feels like 93, an incredibly frustrating year. Beat Collingwood at Victoria Park, beat Carlton at Princess Park, beat Geelong by 12 goals at Waverley, beat North twice, who were on top of the ladder all year, but had some bad losses in there too. And obviously the Nicky Windmayer episode where he left the club for a bit, Plugger was injured. What from your point of view, as someone inside the club, went wrong in 93? Because it feels like it was an opportunity in an even season for us to do a bit better than that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it just went pear-shaped, didn't it? There was a lot of things going on internally that, you know, everyone started to see. And I think that the strength of the management wasn't enough to, you know, keep things under control. And unfortunately, just, you know, it went the wrong way. And our season was, you know, up and down. You can't do all those things then lose the, some of the games we did to how we did and not make the finals. And, you know, we didn't deserve to at the end of the day. It was, yeah, but I think when you look back and you think of all the things that happened through that time, it should never have even gone that way. It shouldn't have happened, you know, and it wouldn't happen in this day and age the way that happened then. But, you know, it did. And, you know, that was the end of certain things around the club.
I want to ask you about your jumper numbers. Obviously, you started in the 44 and played a couple of seasons in 44 and moved to number 8. And then were ahead of the 94 season, I think moved to number 1. How did the jumper numbers get assigned? Did you have any say? Like, how did that work?
I'm not too sure how that all worked. I think I spoke about Murray Ablett before. He was a recruiter, but he played a few reserve games in the early 80s. He wore 58, so that was actually my first number in the reserves. In my first reserve game in 87, I kicked 11 goals, 4 against Sydney up in Sydney. I hadn't had a kick actually in the first 22 minutes. I looked up and I hadn't had a kick in the first quarter. Then by quarter time, I had 6. So I kicked 11 goals, 4 and 3 hit the post. So that was the number 58. So then I got to 44. They just offered me 44 because 58 was obviously too high. I'm not too sure. And then after a couple of seasons, there was number 8. I think Peter Russo left and they said, do you want to come number 8? And I said, yeah, okay, I will. Don't know if I should have or I shouldn't have. But then 94, Barks wrote a letter and asked when, I think Stephen Newport asked if I could wear number 1. So that was my ultimate, you know, dream to wear number 1. It was pretty cool to have that.
So your first 3 Brownlow vote game in your career, got against Fitzroy, 24, round 24, 31 disposals, kicked the goal. You picked up Brownlow votes before then. Do you think you may have hadn't been recognised for the efforts you'd put in some of the games? Like you picked up a 1 or a 2 or that sort of thing, but the 3 finally came along. Do you think there's any games you probably should have got one before then?
Lockett, Lowe, Harvey, Wimmer, Burke, McAdam, Frawley, Grant. I'm still going down. I am below the bottom of that list, and I tried to grow my hair long. I tried to wear long sleeves, as they said, because you might get some, you know, umpires look. But let's be honest, you know, like to for me to be playing with those players and even think I could get a Brownlow vote, you know, against some of the players we're playing against, you know, it's phenomenal. So yeah, like certainly not thinking I should have got more. That's for sure.
Yeah, so it's all down to a name.
Well, when you got Robert Harvey running around, you know, getting 35 possessions, you're getting tagged by 4 different people a quarter. You know, like it's, and you got Plugger kicking 150 goals, and we're coming 30th on the ladder, or whatever the case is. You got Lowy taking 280 marks a year, like you know, Winmar's running through the centre, just doing what he likes. You know, so
your name popped up on Twitter a couple of weeks ago because somebody shared the bit of commentary, not of the Sheldon incident, but of the winning goal in that same game. They just said, I'll finish the passage of play. What happened here? And you were the answer to that question. And people started talking about you a bit, and Trevor Barker was obviously noted not just as a superstar, but he was pretty popular with the ladies during his career. And I got the impression from Twitter that so were you, based on the replies that everybody had through, that you were something of a favourite. Did that come across? Did you get that impression from the crowd? Because these days it's remembered that way.
Very happily married for 20 years now. And, look. I think the crowd was up and down on me a lot. To be honest, like, you know, I think they had a bit of a love-hate relationship with me for various reasons. There was a big thing. Trevor gave me he did this thing for the Herald Sun. He gave me his black book at one stage, and it was a bit of write up about it and had a bit of fun about certain things. But yeah. It's just, it's all good fun, you know.
I want to ask you what happened at the end of 1995, because when I look back as a fan, and you know, I was five, six, in those early 90 years and kind of grew up through that period. And I had no recollection until last week of your time at Carlton. And then I went back and had a look, and you were traded for pick 19, which was Barry Hall. Barry Hall came to the club with that pick. But I guess what facilitated that move? Was it something that you asked for? Did the club kind of force it through? How did that happen?
Yeah, it just Stan and I saw things differently. You know, I'm so upset that I had to leave. I never wanted to leave. I was actually going to West Coast. The deal had been done, and then St Kilda pulled out of it because I think they offered Turley and the full forward who actually come the next year. What was his name?
Heatley.
Yeah, so I had a pretty strong friendship with Chris Mainwaring for a long time, and Mick Mouldhouse, and I spent a week with Mick Mouldhouse in Melbourne, and I was there, and then they pulled out of it the last day, and then so then Carlton rang up, and I was able to go there after that. Look, it's such a sad thing. I think I was a bit done. I was jogging and doing my calf. I just couldn't get games together, and I signed a decent contract for some years, and then it just wasn't working for them. So after the first year, they decided they didn't want me anymore. So, and then I did a preseason, went straight to the Bulldogs, did a preseason under Terry Wallace in 97. And I was the last person left in there, and he'd come to me the night before the draft and said, yep, we're going to draft you. And then later on that night, he got a phone call from a 6'6" guy in Adelaide whom he said that they took him, which I believe is the swimmer's dad who wins all the gold medals now, 100 metre swimmer.
The South Australian. Yeah.
So don't like his dad. He rang up and said he's going to come, and he never came. He had a $50 bet with his mates so he could get drafted that night, and he didn't. Whatever went to the Bulldogs, so he sort of took me out of that. So yeah, that was it. Unfortunately,
so early in that time at Carlton, you obviously come up against St Kilda in the night grand final. Well, you see, because I think most of the footage I saw of you watching the tape back years later was a lot of time on the bench, it seemed to be. But were you watching on, looking at St Kilda, sort of thinking, hey, that team actually could go somewhere? Just that night, it just all gelled, everything worked. Did it look like a team that was going to go somewhere in those next few years?
Oh, look, I was the only person in navy blue that was smiling. So make of that what you will. But they were phenomenal that night. They just seemed to have changed and had risen into this, you know, just gelled team. And the younger players had come through beautifully. It was really surreal playing against the players who I'd played with for nine years or so. I was very happy for them, you know, that they won the premiership and where they were going to go from there, because it seems good.
Now, you played the one game with Carlton, two goals from a couple of kicks against Melbourne. Probably don't need to talk too much about the rest of your time at Carlton, but I want to ask, I guess, going back to your time at St Kilda, you rattled off an amazing list of names that you played with. Who was the best? You talk about Plugger, Spud, Haves, Winmar, Lowe, Burke, all those guys. Who's the best player that you played with? And I guess, secondly, some of those guys that are no longer with us, Trevor Barker and Danny Frawley, what are some of your memories of those two guys?
Yeah. Look, between how do you go past Lockett? Like, seriously, what he could do. Just amazing agility, amazing. He can take these massive grabs over, you know, packs. He was just so fast. His goal-kicking ability, you know, just unbelievable. And you've got someone like Robert Harvey, you get 35 hard possessions a game. You know, you've watched 35 possessions these days, and they get six in 3 seconds. He did not get six in 3 seconds. He ran, you know, 25 Ks a game. And you've got Stuart Lowe, who, would you know, how many marks is the best player take now? I'm not too sure, but it's not 280. I'm pretty sure it'd be under 150. You know, so the team that we actually had, when you look back, it's amazing that there wasn't, you know, two or three premierships really there. So out of those players, you know, yeah, look, I'm and we, how do I go past Winmar, watching him run around unbelievable what he did. You know, like you're on the ground and you just cannot believe what you're seeing. So, but Plugger probably sits at the top. Danny Frawley was unbelievable to me. He was, the captain and had a very good friendship with him, did a lot of work with him with the AFL, different clinics and stuff. So I spent a lot of time with him. He was always there to, you know, support you, back you up. Yeah, look, obviously a sad thing with Spartan, you know, to think you just can't ring him up anymore and have a chat to him and him be smart to you and, you know, like, and then ring you back later and just, you know, just, I heard that question. Yeah, you got to do this. You know, you sort of, he's a captain and he's sort of took that role on seems for life for some players, you know, and that's such an important thing to have, to be able to call up a role model, someone he looked up to or someone, you know, to have that ability to do that. And Trevor was just my hero, still is. You know, to him to take me on board as, you know, when I was 16, I used to stay at his house on weekends to train and come to the footy. And, you know, we had this amazing friendship that we used to come up to the Gold Coast every year together at the end of the season. He used to cook me breakfast when he retired, cook me breakfast every Saturday morning. I used to have bacon and eggs at his house Saturday mornings, you know, and I still can't believe it. He's the sort of guy, when I got my jaw broken in 88, I used to go to his house and he'd make me soup and he'd eat an apple and a steak in front of me. you know, he's just, you know, the kindest, nicest hearted person. And for the superstar, megastar he was for that club and for the VFL, AFL, he's just, I miss him all the time. Like, I always think of him. I always wish I could talk to him. I always wish he could meet my kids. You know, I just miss him. I do get a bit emotional when I talk about him, sorry.
No, not a problem. Just last one from me, mate. You're wearing the Skills Beast T-shirt, I can see.
Yes, thank you.
You played with Plugger, and now you're working with Jason Dunstall. why don't you give the listeners a bit of a wrap of what Skills Beast is and how that came about?
Yep, about 5 years ago, I was just watching a bit of footy and stuff, and I saw a massive problem with skill technique. That was one of my things. I think I had pretty much well for my left and right foot. I thought I was quite a skilled player. And I woke up one morning and just started writing all stuff down about what's needed to be, you know, how to kick, what to do. And I come up with a training aid, which you put around your waist. It's a sleeve. And then there's a rotation cord that comes out. And I put it on, and it actually worked. When you put this on, you could actually kick a drop punt. So I give it to my daughters. I gave it to some friends who can't tip that well, and they put it on straight away. And within two kicks, they were kicking a drop punt. So we haven't got the hardest ball in the world to kick. It's not round, and, you know, it can drop anywhere, go anywhere. So I started off with a plumbing, you know, the white plumbing tube. Yeah, sorry, cut that up, put that there. And anyway, cut a long story short, I got a bit further down. I got some shin guards when you see Skills Beast, honestly, I mean, I got some shin guards to put on. I made it. And I looked around and I had a relationship with Jason in the early 90s. We used to do a bit of stuff again, to go to the races and hang out a little bit here and there. I hadn't spoken to him for a long time. And I gave him a call and I said, "Bung, I said, I've got this thing that I've invented. I'd like you to have a look at it, please. Because I think I've got something here for the AFL." And he said, "You can show me, but I'm not going to like it, but you can come and show me anyway." I said, "There you go. That's just how he is." I'm on the Gold Coast. So I flew down to see him and we're meeting up at his house, and then we're going to go to the park at Albert Park that's near him, and get there. And it's pouring with rain. So we can't go out and have a kick. So I'm showing him the Skills Beast, in his lounge room. So we're in his lounge room. We just got it on and we're kicking the footy in his lounge room. Anyway, he calls it a light bulb moment. He thinks it's the most amazing thing. Every kid, every player should need it to have, you know, kicking the left and right foot. So yeah, from that day, he helped me make it into the beast it is, I guess, today by fine tuning it and having it how it is now. And he's been unbelievable the way he talks about it and has it. It's just a great training aid for any kid who wants to use it or any, you know, like we've been fortunate enough to have a few AFL clubs have it during pre-season to help some kids and help some put people with their goal kicking and their field kicking. So we're hopefully we're in discussions with the AFL. They're spending $1 billion over the next 10 years, and we hope that some might come our way, and we can definitely help some kids and girls and whoever needs a bit of advice on and to kick for coaches.
Final to finish up here, you've spoken about the players that you played with and the players that you loved and that sort of thing. Going from that's in the past now. You're obviously still a St Kilda fan.
Yep. Yep. I live on the Gold Coast, so I get to watch a lot. When they come up here, I certainly go and watch them. I'm a big fan of Steele, and I have been from the start. I think he's a great leader. I just love how he's the one that's now that does the Lenny Hayes things. I think, and if I was going to pick one to watch who I really enjoyed watching last year was Mitch Allens. I think he's going to be the one to take us the next 10 years. He's a serious player. Well, the way he attacks the ball and the way he thinks about certain things, he's really good.
A good shout. Craig, it's been a pleasure going through your journey, some wonderful moments. It was a great era of footy, and we've spoken to a lot of guys that played footy with you during that period. It's probably no coincidence that we've gravitated back to that particular side. But thank you very much for joining us, and we wish you all the best going forward.
No, thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
Yeah, they're amazing. The Collingwood memories in 92, the spray, the goal from the boundary, when, you know, the bit of commentary from Bruce McAvaney with Craven's on his own in the goal square. 80,000 people. It was our first game at the MCG since they reopened it with the Great Southern Stand. And he then kicked a huge goal against Collingwood in the final. Obviously, we know for those listening to the podcast, some of you might get in and tweet us that there's a few stories around Craig Devenport's life outside of football, but for obvious legal reasons, we can't really talk about those. And I hope you understand that. We're not ignoring it. We are aware of it. But that's not our matter to discuss, and it's not necessarily what the show is about. So hopefully that is clearing up any of that. We look to some listener questions. Now, a reminder also that we have been on YouTube for a while, but we are kicking that up a gear as well. So please subscribe and like and comment on our videos. We'll do a few different things around how we package those up. And leave us reviews and ratings on whatever your podcast providers are, Spotify, iTunes, Facebook, any of those types of things. So just, you know, you can give us whatever reviewing you like. Hopefully it's 5 stars, but you can be as honest as you want. Looking at some listener questions, a few points we haven't discussed, which we might if we get time, but some listener questions. Zaka says, have you missed the feeling of dread and impending doom that comes with a St Kilda game, especially one against Geelong? Interesting question. I think the dread part is always normal. There's all of those nerves that kick in. Probably not the feeling of dread so much, but, yeah, the butterflies in the stomach, H, are coming back. And yeah. You certainly miss those.
The feeling of dread, I think, comes from not taking the opportunity to beat them at this time. Yeah. I think that's more where it is. You go, oh, we should win. And in the back of your head, it just goes, but you probably won't. it's just the whole Geelong thing, as we're saying before. Like, yeah, I mean, we go in with a lot more confidence than we have other times. I think that's one thing we can say about it. That yeah, it's there for us to take, I think, this game. So. Yeah, as I said, get down there and just, well, the 15 St Kilda fans that can get into the game, cheer loud and, get us over the line.
Those that are getting down there might have to watch it in pubs. Michael, similar question to a couple of other people have asked along these lines. Who will be relief ruckman on Saturday to give Roe a chop out? And Shay says, thoughts on Cheeto, Mitch Owens, being second ruck option. Do we need to bring someone else in? Nick, how do you feel about that option with Mitch?
We talked about this a little bit last year. And, look, I think if Jack Hayes was fit and healthy, then he's the obvious one to play that kind of forward role, you know, centre half forward, can push up to the wing, can pinch hit in the ruck and do all those sorts of things. But clearly he's not fit and healthy, and he hasn't been for a while. Mitch Owens is the one that Ross has gone to, I think, in some of those moments over the last 12 months. And clearly in the two preseason games, he's gone back to that. I think, you know, we might see some occasions where it's, you know, down in defense that Cordy takes a tap every now and then. But I think if it's through the middle of the ground or up forward, then Mitch, it looks like, is the favorite to kind of take that role. I don't particularly like it. But I think we have to accept that that's what Ross is doing and what he wants to do. And I think at this point, we just have to kind of trust Ross.
Look, I think Mitch is pretty good at it.
I agree.
Yeah. Certainly as an extra midfielder, it's important. It's just you're always worried about slightly undersized players getting hurt in the ruck and those sorts of things.
The way you've got to watch that is you need to, if their ruck's not on the field, Rowe's on the field. If he goes off, give Rowan a rest, or bring him off slightly afterwards, just to see if he can dominate for a few minutes, and then give him the quick rest and get him back out there again. Like, he doesn't have to be out there until there's a goal kicked. That's one thing when you look at it. So around the ground, a ball in ruck contest, he's probably like, there's not as much danger in that, clearly. But it's the centre bounce one that you're more worried about. You go, well, as long as Rowan can get out there when there is a goal kicked and get back into the ruck position, and then we should be fine.
Yeah, and I think I think Mitch ultimately is going to end up being an elite midfielder, and that's where he'll play. I think that's where he's, you know, as a junior, calling him, and when we were talking to Shifter about it, he was a phenomenal midfielder, and maybe playing as a ruckman / fourth midfielder is the start of that journey back in there, maybe. So, one thing about Mitch, and it's amazing to say that about a 19-year-old, he's basically done the job wherever we've put him. So, I'm sure that'll happen again. Bobber Khan H says, what's a pass mark for 2024?
Well, you'd hope most people's pass mark is being pretty well in that same spot we were as last year, at least. If we can get to that final again. We don't know who we would be coming up against. It's quite open this year. We could end up against a Collingwood or something if they drop a little bit or something like that. And if we get put up against them in the first final, you think, we've got a real struggle on our hand there, because clearly the last year's premiers, it's going to be hard to defeat them, that sort of thing. And you go, let's get to that point first. Let's get to that point of maybe battling for fifth, get back to sixth, possibly seventh if it's Melbourne team, we're still in Melbourne for a final. It's just that area is where we need to look and go, okay, let's get back to that point and try again, get past what we did last year. And if we get to that point there, that's where we can launch from. So I think, same as last year, where we were, get there first and then see what we can do from there.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think as a pass mark, Nick, you generally want to hold your ground. So finish where you finished the year before. I mean, if you're a wooden spoon or a pass mark, is to move up. But I think if you're a final side like us, it would be to stay around about that mark as a pass, and then obviously better than that as a success.
Yeah, generally, it's a really interesting question for a team like ours, because you know, a lot of people still think that we made finals probably a little bit prematurely last season, and there is kind of a general consensus that there are a couple of clubs that are on the up as well, you know, whether they make finals or not. But you know, a couple of clubs that should be improving off the back of, you know, their second half of last year, their draft and trade periods, their all those sorts of things. So a pass mark is very difficult to identify, because a lot of people will just say, well, it's finals. But we can be a better team than last year and not make finals. If a lot of those things happen, that there's three or four clubs that get better and they play finals, we can be a better team than we were last year and not make finals. And I think we're at a stage where we are still in a building phase, and finals isn't the be-all and end-all. As much as I want to be there and you know, we want to be there, we feel like we need to be there and all those sorts of things. If there are clear steps forward, we improve our game style, you know, we're more confident ball in hand, you know, hitting targets in terms of transition, all those sorts of things. There are a lot of things that we can continue getting better at. And I think if we do that and we continue building and taking those steps to get better as a team and the individuals get better and coaching gets better and all these sorts of things, then I think if we can sit there at the end of round 24 or whatever it is and say we are better than we were last year, then I think I'll be content with that. Whether we're in sixth, eighth, or ninth, it doesn't really matter. I want to play finals. I love that taste of it that we got again last September. And ultimately, that's where we want to be and where we have to be if we want to be a contending team. But I'm not sure that that needs to be the pass mark this season. I think it will be in coming seasons. But I think if we can see that we are a better team than last year, then I think we're on the right track. And that's ultimately where we should be talking.
Yeah, I think if your ultimate aim is to win a flag, do you move closer to that? That doesn't mean you go up the ladder or whatever it may be, but just if you are closer to midnight or whatever it is on the clock. And Tim says, how do you feel about experts across the board and their group think that it's a given we drop out? It seems like Adelaide, Geelong and the Bulldogs will certainly move back in. We weren't far off the Glory Boy Orange team last year and we should be better this season. Look, I agree with those last two points. We had a big go against us in that final against the Giants and they were close to the best team in the comp by the end of the year and may well be now. Adelaide, yes. Bulldogs, yes. Geelong, yes. I can understand the improvement in those sides, but I think we stack up list-wise pretty well against all of them. And you made the point, Tim, groupthink. I actually think there's been a little bit of that in there. There are some analysts that might be against us, and there are some analysts who are for us. I think the wheels turned a little bit in the last few weeks. I think some have come back around the other way to thinking we might be better than they perhaps first thought. But I actually think some of the, because there's so many publications these days, but if you look at the Herald Sun or the AFL website and a lot of those where they've tipped ladders, I actually think it's lazy, to be honest. I think not everybody watches every game. Not everybody analyzes every list. I think it's almost like, oh, who's going to be the big slider this year? Oh, everyone's saying St Kilda, aren't they? I'll put them in there. To be honest, I genuinely think it's a little bit of that. I think there are some people that have analyzed it and come to that opinion, and that's fine. You're allowed to do that. Not everybody's going to say you're going to be fantastic, and you won't always be, but I do get the feeling there is a little bit of that. Oh, that's the consensus. So that must be right. So I'll tip that as well. It's been pretty lazy, and it shouldn't annoy me, but it does a little bit. I think it's been, we've almost been criminally underrated in many respects. I think our season last year, I had an argument with someone on social media last year who said that our season last year was the most disappointing of any side in the competition. And I'm like, that is the stupidest opinion I've ever heard on sports, like any sport ever. And it's remarkable that things like that exist. But let them think what they want to think. And it just makes it better if you stick it up them. So,
well, you go back to the chat we had with Fine last week, and he made the point that if our list was wearing different colours, would the sentiment be the same? And I think he's right that I think that our list does stack up, and I think that there is plenty of improvement to come in a team that had a pretty decent year last year. Like, yes, there were moments, and yes, the second half was a bit shaky and all those sorts of things, but they're a year stronger, a year older, a year wiser, another year into the coaching group, you know, all these things that are important for a young team, essentially. That I think we get better, and so the consensus that we're a big slider, I think, like you said, is lazy. Doesn't necessarily guarantee that we make finals either, but I think that narrative is lazy, and I agree.
So thinking of one expert who has been very critical of us in the past, who's jumping on us now, David King. I sort of think, just imagine how excited he would be if we were North Melbourne and Machito Owens played for him. He would be exploding.
But he doesn't have to worry.
He wouldn't get a game. He wouldn't get a game for North because they've got 10 Mateus Filippos in there.
Yeah, that's right. He wouldn't have to worry. They've got too many Filippos in their lineup.
But if
so
we were
fine.
Actually, yeah, but if this was actually North Melbourne, he is getting so excited about us this year, and he's probably a good. A good one to follow sort of thing, because you think he has been very critical of us in past years. And at times you sort of look back and go, he was kind of right. It was, we didn't live up to possibly what we could have been in those few years. And he was a little bullish about us last year. He said, look, he kind of thought we might go okay. And yes, we made finals. But at the start of this year, he's got very excited about us. And so I thought I'd go, hey, let's ride the way that he's actually given us for once. Because, yeah, it's since he's been in the media, I guess we haven't done a whole lot. But, yeah, if we could get as excited about it, Mitch as he does, then, yeah, let's go.
And unlike the others, David King went to every Victorian team training and observed that type of stuff. So that's actual proper analysis. So hopefully that ends up being right. Just a couple of rapid fires before we wrap things up, only because we didn't discuss them. So it's almost an inner word, because I don't know how much more we need to talk about it, but inner words, H, Tarryn Thomas, if he were to be available.
No, not the moment, no.
Nick?
I'm the same. It's no for me. I think if we were potentially closer to a flag, and you've got to have that kind of ruthless streak when it comes to building a list and a premiership team, then maybe closer, but it's a definite no for me at this point.
Yeah, I'm a definite no. I don't think we need everything that comes with that, and there's still some, you know, unsavoury stuff around it. Ben King, if he does re-sign as expected with the Gold Coast, is that it? I mean, to be honest, it's felt like that's been it for a while. And look, I don't think it's such a bad thing. I think everyone leaves the Gold Coast, and it's not a case of, I mean, stuff them, they're a, you know, plastic popcorn club, but I don't think it's good for the competition if you got players walking out all the time in that situation. So do we put the Ben King thing to bed, Nick?
I think so. I agree with you. I think it's not good that you end up having feeder teams for the big clubs. We've been that at times. And we've seen a lot of gun kids play kind of 3 or 4 years at some of these smaller clubs and then go on to Essendon or Carlton or, you know, Collingwood or whatever. And it's not good for the competition. And if Ben King can kind of be that one that says, no, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to play my career on the Gold Coast and hopefully lead this team to some success, then good on him. Obviously, I'd love to see him in red, white and black, but I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, his brother win date, Coleman's, it doesn't really matter.
And, I mean, the thing is, if we look at it at the moment, do we need him? Is there going to be really that spot right now? Who would we kick out? Yeah, who would we kick out to bring him in?
Yeah. That's certainly not our highest priority.
Yeah.
No, well, I think potentially when he was playing as a key defender, I think that was when you know the reality suited the narrative at that point. As a key forward, right now, do you drop Tim Membry? Probably. I mean,
no.
On pure skill, you probably do, but from a team building perspective, do you probably not? I mean, Sharman King would play ahead of Sharman, but again, how does that make your forward line too unbalanced at that stage?
Hmm.
Yeah, I think we have other priorities that we need to kind of focus on in terms of building this list.
And the Gold Coast have a few of those that I would take for sure, like through the midfield, even defence. So, yeah, that's not a knock on Ben. He's a star, but I think they've got even some resources that I would, if they said come and take anyone from the Suns, I'm not taking him first, put it that way.
So, Noah Anderson.
100%. Or even maybe Matt Rowles showing him, but he had 25 appearances or something on the weekend. Powell, the other youngster in the middle. There's a number that you would look at in that space. But in the meantime, we're working out who they'll pick against Geelong, which you may already know at the time of listening to this. But we are finally here, and hopefully we have a victory over Geelong at Cadinia Park this century. It's been a little while, so feels like we're ready. It's the most, almost said the readiest, if that's not a word, the most ready we've been in a very long time to do that. So, bring it on, and for those heading down the highway, enjoy the trip, and hopefully we can come back with some 4 points. But go Saints.